When you talk about the scientists, was there always a scientist at each of the control stations? The control centers?
What the operational setup was in the control was that there would be three crews of about 30 people. Obviously, like a post had an overall manning of 10, the idea being three sets of three observers, because on a post, the operational crew was three, so it's three times three to cover the 24 hours, because the idea was 8 hours, 8 hours, and 8 hours. And a chief observer in charge, that's how they got the figure of 10. In a control, they would have three crews of 30, that's 90 people. The idea being that for the first 8 hours, it would be crew one. If nothing happened, they would go home and another 30 would come on. The controls were much more labour-intensive than the posts, because they had a lot more functions to carry out, like data transmission. They had to do a lot of plotting, telling, interpretation of other information coming in from adjoining groups, from the military, from local authorities, etc., etc. In the group control, they had two groups of people. One was the observer corps, and it was the observer corps' job to do all the, what can I call it, the operational plotting, recording, etc., etc. They got another team of people called the warning team. The warning team people were directly employed by the United Kingdom Warning and Monitoring Organisation, and they were controlled by the by the United Kingdom Warning and Monitoring Organisation. In each group, there was a group commandant, spare timer, in charge of the observer corps people, and he had a role in the group control. But as well as that, the warning team, as we call them, there was a group controller who was in charge of them. Now, these people, the warning team, were, I'll call them scientists, but they studied the much finer points and the much more scientific characteristics of radioactivity, of radiation decay, the effects of radiation, the characteristics of bombs. They would carry out modifications to forecasts. It was their prime role to actually forecast where fallout was going to go and at what intensity. It was quite an onerous responsibility. The Observer Corps didn't do forecasting work. It was the warning team to give advice as well. So we've got two distinct roles. One is receiving data, displaying data, plotting data, which was done by the Royal Observer Corps. And the warning team, who were, I'll call them scientists, they were the ones who actually took the raw data and they plotted and calculated the actual plumes, the forecasts, and they were the ones that gave advice. I mean, if for example, a military customer wanted some advice, it would not normally be given by a member of the Observer Corps. It would be given by a member of the warning team, because that was their role. So obviously, there were no members of the warning team out in the posts. They were only at group control. As I say, going back to the posts, the posts would simply record 5-minute readings for the duration of the exercise or for the war. Once the war had started, i.e. the bomb had gone off, clearly there would be no more rotation of crews unless there were no bombs in the vicinity of that post. The scenario for attack was debated endlessly. And to begin with, the scenario was for a number of very large bombs detonated on London, Sheffield, Manchester, Bristol and so on. Large populations. But as the delivery systems became more accurate, then the scenario changed to many more smaller bombs detonated on strategic installations like airfields, dockyards, power stations. So you'd got two distinct scenarios. One was a relatively few number of bombs, but big bombs that would create a lot of fallout. Or the other scenario was, say, 100 bombs, but much smaller. In all cases, if the bombs were detonated on or near the ground, they would produce fallout, and all those bombs would have to be calculated in terms of radioactive fallout and radioactive fallout prediction. If the bombs were airburst, you would only get the damage in the vicinity of where the bombs had gone off, and very little radiation would go downwind from an airburst weapon. Horrific as they may be, they would not be anything like as dangerous as a groundburst weapon. So they were the scenarios for attack. As I say, it did change quite a lot. One thing which always frustrated some units in the Observer Corps was whenever we had an exercise, the exercises varied in time duration. They would normally be held on a Sunday for about 8 hours, and occasionally we would have a weekend exercise which would be 24 hours, called Intex. They have unusual names of it, like Warmon, Postex, or Intex. And on every exercise, there would probably be anything up to 120 bombs detonated on the UK. Now, that is a ludicrously high number, totally unrealistic. I'm of the opinion that 2, 3, 4 bombs would have brought Great Britain to its knees. But, of course, I brought this up at several debriefs and several meetings, and I was told that because it cost a lot of money to switch all the lines, to pay for all the telephone lines, it cost a lot of money to get all the observers, nationally I'm talking about, 10,000 people, actually playing war games, then they had to maximise every point, every location of the Observer Corps, which meant that you're giving every post a bomb, just for the sake of it, just to give them experience in reporting things. It did produce an overall ludicrous, complicated display. But the teams at control did try to do that. I think the assumption was if you can sort out and plot a national picture of 120 bombs, you would certainly be able to do it for 5. but it was unrealistic. And it did cause, sometimes it caused clogging up of the system in terms of data and everything else. Towards the early mid-1980s, there was a communications revolution in the Corps, because a lot of the data was late, a lot of the data was delayed, there were problems with it, it was incomplete, because the system was via an ordinary telephone line going through ordinary exchanges and arriving in the form of punched tape in the controls or any other customer, whether it be military or local authority. Around about 1982, the post office gave the Observer Corps an electronic box, quite a big box, called a message switch. And the message switch was some computerised switching system which allowed communications from one unit to another to be altered, fiddle around. If somebody went out due to some reason, then the message switch would automatically reroute lines and things like that. And this improved the flow of data dramatically. It meant, for example, if bombs were being detonated in northern Scotland within minutes, they could have been down in Truro, for example. So that revolutionised the way the Observer Corps actually operated in the controls. With the message switch came a change with teleprinters. We went from punch tape to page copy printer, which was a lot better because it was in, I'll call it in English.
So that was like a telex machine,
yeah,
in effect.
Yeah, right? I mean, all the messages we had, you would think they were in code. It was a bit like Bletchley Park with the deciphering of the Enigma and things like that. But all the messages were in code. But of course, when you knew what you were doing and what you were looking for, you could understand the code. It wasn't a code in the sense that it was totally jumbled up. There was some logic in it. I mean, for example, a bomb burst message. Anything that was preceded by BB It was a bomb burst message. And it would say BB, Truro Alpha, which meant it was the first bomb to be picked up in the Truro group. BB, Truro Alpha, 10:58. It went off at 10:58, nearly 11 o'clock. A GRF reference, Tango Foxtrot 4567, which would be the GRF. GRF is a military geographic grid. And then there would be Sierra Kilo 3456, which is the national grid position. 1 megaton, the power, detonated at 2,000 feet, two, T or C, touching or clear, which meant that the bomb was either ground burst or not. And that was a typical bomb burst message. But it would look, to the layman, it would look as if it was in code. And there were codes for every other type of message. Whether it was fallout messages, for example, were called CCs. So if you had a CC, it would say CC 1100. This is the dose rate readings for 1100. And it would say 10 space 2.5, 11 space 3.6, 12 space 15. What that was saying was CC meant dose rate readings. For 10 posts, it was 5. For 11 posts, it was 2.6. For 12 posts, it was 15. And that's all that meant. And for every other type of data, we had these codes. And of course, the observers were totally and utterly expert in reading them off just like that. So, I mean, at one stage, in fact, quite a number of the displays were transparent. In the controls, in particular, they worked on display A and B. Display A was a big Perspex display, lit up, very futuristic in a sense. And the observers plotted on one side and the scientists worked on the other. The scientists, actually, this is typical, the scientists worked on the logical side so they could read the English. And the Observer Corps people had to work on the other side and they had to write backwards.
Everything was in reverse.
Everything was
including
in reverse.
Including the map of the...
Including the map. So the observers were trained to read and plot and write backwards, which is quite a feat, actually. And it was somewhat amusing because the Observer Corps people were regarded as less, I'll call it less intelligent than the warning team. Yet the warning team were reading it in a logical, straightforward way, and the observers had to write it all backwards, mirror image sort of thing. But that was done. There are a lot of other things done as well in the controls. For every post that was reporting fallout readings every 5 minutes, and you can imagine in 1 hour there's 12 readings, and those readings would indicate either a rising dose rate or a falling dose rate or a static dose rate. Those readings would record a rising peak, falling and maybe kicking up again, which would mean another fallout front had come to that post. All these readings were plotted on log charts, and there would be a team of observers doing nothing but plot 5 minute readings. Now, can you imagine 35 posts in a group sending in readings every 5 minutes, and there was a log chart in operation for every post? That's 35 log charts, and all these readings were being plotted. So at the end of the day, you had a graph, in other words, of the dose rate at that particular point. These could be used by the scientists to determine how the fallout was decaying and where the intense fallouts were. One of the most... the first display the warning teams used to do was an initial prediction display. Obviously, as soon as a bomb had gone off, the idea would be to calculate where the fallout was going to go, if any. And that was the job of the warning team. And they would draw on the map a fallout plume. If the wind was fast, the fallout plume would tend to be long and narrow. If the wind was light, then the fallout plume would be shorter and fat. Within that fallout plume, you would indicate where the fallout was predicted to arrive on an hourly basis. So this is way before the fallout had actually come down. This is done very quickly in the first instance. The idea being that if you know where the fallout is going to go, I always tell people at the very post, if Custer had known where the Indians were, he could have done something about it. If you know where the fallout's going to go, you can tell people to get under cover or get them out of the way. People think that they'll just die. The truth is that there could have been many, many pockets, many, many areas totally unaffected by fallout. And if you're in those areas, you're perfectly safe. It's a bit like being either under rain or not under rain. And if there's no rain there, you don't get wet. So the idea was that using the radio, using police, using whatever, informing the public was not our role. We would simply tell the police or the local authorities that that is the fallout prediction. And the idea was that people would be got under cover or out of the way. When fallout readings started to develop in the control, then the scientists would draw, or the observer corps would draw in the first instance, a fallout plume of actual readings. Now clearly, the post readings on the edges of the fallout plume would be very light or very small. The ones in the centre of the plume, the hot line we call it, would be very high. And to give you an example, over a plume width of 10 miles, you could get 0.1 on the edges and 400 or 500 or 1,000 on the hot line. Clearly, the 1,000 level area would be very relatively short, and the 100 would be longer, and the 10 would be longer still. Ultimately, the scientists would draw what they call a DR7 map. DR7 map, in terms of survival, it was a very important map. It was a map of the group area, and by that I'm talking, in our case, Devon and Cornwall. It was a map which showed every bomb burst, and it would show a series of plumes emanating from that bomb, all of them going downwind. It would be called a DR7 map because it would be like a contour map of a plume. The inner contour line would be the highest radiation level of all, say 1,000. And the next one would be 100, the next one would be 10, the next one would be 1. If you calculated what the fallout was going to be 7 hours after burst, at any one point, if anyone asked you what's the fallout level going to be there in 3 weeks, if you'd got a DR7 map available to you, using the 7/10 rule, you could actually assess what the fallout was going to be at any subsequent time. So the calculation of a DR7 was quite a critical calculation. It was very complex, actually. And I've constructed many DR7 maps. And it's a fascinating process because you are averaging, you are proportioning out readings all the time to make it show some sort of sense. To do it for one plume is relatively, I'll call it easy, it's time consuming but easy. But where you've got overlapping plumes, it gets so complex, it's just unbelievable. But that's the DR7 map, and that was done in the console, and that was done by the warning team. I think that's about it.
I was going to talk to you a bit more about data. So there were two forms of communication, really, which was the telephone
and the radio.
Was there anything out there? So basically, for example, at Verian Post, then people would have just used the telephone or a fixed wire service to feed that data in constantly.
Yeah. They would have, at Verian Post, because it wasn't a master post, they would have the teletalk. Now, the teletalk is a loudspeaker telephone. The telephones the observer called post use were not like your desk telephone. It was a bit like a loudspeaker with a transmit button on it. And if you want to make a report, you would simply press the transmit button and speak into the loudspeaker, which was a microphone as well. The teletalks were alive all the time. So when you went on duty and switched it on, you could hear anything else which was said on that line. Now, the posts were clustered in 3, 4, or 5 posts, so you would hear your neighbouring posts. In the case of Verium Post, you would hear Mevagissey, you would hear St Anthony when it was operational, you would hear Penryn, you would hear the neighbouring post talking. If you want to call someone, you would say, Verium was 67 post. 67 post, come in 66 post. You know, is that you, Bill? You know, what did you do last night? You could talk like that to your neighbouring post. Once you pressed the transmit button, you couldn't hear what was being said. So the transmit button actually cut off the broadcast facility. You had to remember, in fact, we used to say 67 post calling 66 post over, and then release the button. And then the other guy would know to come in, and you could hear him. So there was a sequence, and there was a procedure to follow.
It was like a two-way radio then, really.
Yeah, it was a two-way radio. Right. Yeah, yeah.
And those lines were open all the time, so BT.
No, they were there all the time, but they were only switched for an exercise. So it cost too much. I mean, the Observer Corps telephone bill was horrendous for a peacetime organisation. So no, they were only ever switched on an exercise 5-6 times a year. We did actually have all sorts of problems. Sometimes you would go on, you would switch the teletalk on, and it would be dead. And so they were the days before mobile phones were really in, and you would have to get in your car, go to the nearest phone booth and phone up group console and say, hey, you know, we've not got any contact. Can you get the GPO engineer? And the GPO engineer would have to go through the rigmarole of line testing and all that lot. And then very often, 2 hours, 3 hours later, halfway through the exercise, suddenly it would crackle and come live. It was a bit annoying, actually, when that happened. A lot of criticisms of BT, because the Observer Corps would get this national exercise together, all sorts of people would man their posts, and when they got there, no communications. Well, if you know communications, you have nothing. But that happened more than it should, actually. The message switch improved that dramatically. And it's fair to say that after the message switch, poor communications was, I won't say a thing of the past, but it was certainly improved a lot. So Verium Post just had telephonic communication through a teletalk, as we call it.